Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 106 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I've got the usual crew of co-hosts with me tonight. First, we have Dan Webb. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Max. Good evening, everyone.
Also with us, as always, is David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
Good evening, everyone.
And, of course, we wouldn't be complete without Rob Mark. Hi, Rob.
Hey, hi, and welcome from Chicago, as well as I brought all the locusts with tonight, so I hope the listeners can hear those here in Northern Illinois. It's our sound effects portion.
Yeah, they're back. They're back. Our guest today is Bruce Landsberg. Bruce is president of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association Air Safety Foundation. That's a nonprofit pilot education and safety group. Bruce, welcome. We're very happy to have you here with us.
Well, thank you, Max, and good evening, everyone.
Now, the Air Safety Foundation is an organization that's not just for AOPA members. Is that right?
We're open to any pilot, in fact, anyone who would like to participate in our live seminars or in our free online courses. We make it available to anybody.
That's great. We're looking forward to talking about that in more detail in a little bit. Before we get started, though, Rob, do you want to mention again the activities we have planned for AirVenture?
Well, if the locusts don't interrupt me, I mean, I want to make sure everybody knows that next week is the beginning of Oshkosh AirVenture 2010. Dan Webb and I are going to be doing a special little gig on Tuesday, which is July the 27th, for 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I believe it is, at one of the pavilions. I think it's number 6, just north of the tower. We're going to be having a little get-together for all our kinds of great airplane geeks listeners, as well as some Jetwine readers. And we're going to be talking about social media, and we're going to be talking about practical social media. We're not just getting together to talk about Twitter and Facebook and all that kind of silliness. This is this is social media with an attitude. So that's July 27th. And Bruce, I know you said you're coming in. We're going to be holding a seat for you that afternoon. So I do hope you'll make it, because the seat that has your name on it will look awfully empty if you don't appear. No pressure or anything, though.
Well, I will be largely dependent upon the airline community to get me there, so you may want to have a contingency plan.
Airlines.
There was a long silence. There was a long silence there. I heard that.
Yeah, airlines. Well, okay. All right. I guess we'll have to just depend
afternoon
on the airlines.
Afternoon with the airlines in the summertime. Now, think about that for a moment.
Mm.
What's a couple of thunderstorms between friends? No, well, listen, I hope
a couple of hours of delay.
That's right. So we just hope all of our listeners and some readers get to come out and join us and talk about social media and how we're actually solving some practical problems. We're going to have a great couple of guests. We've got Rod Rakic from My Transponder. We've got John Ostrower from Flight Blogger, who Dan has gotten to know very well this summer, since they're working in the same office. And It's going to be a lot of fun. We actually have some, and we have some Airplane Geeks T-shirts that we're going to give out. I mean, that alone should bring people, don't you think?
Yeah, it should.
Who's paying for the T-shirts, by the way?
That's right. We'll spare the poor, impoverished.
Sent that part to Dan.
All right. Very good. Anything else on that?
No. Just and if people wanted to bring beer, that would be fine, but it's not required.
And so we're going to have a little contest as well.
Absolutely. We might. Well, I think Dan and I are going to talk about maybe doing a little Jeopardy, or who knows what we may do. And then we're going to have our contest to see who might be a great guest for an upcoming show, and we'll be interviewing people on the on site there that afternoon. So it's going to be all kinds of fun.
Coming up, we have this week's aviation news. We're also going to have David's This Week in Aviation, the Australia desk, and we have a pile of listener mail this time. We'll try to get through as much of it as we can, but I think that's going to be a tough task given the volume. But before all that, let's get started with the news. Our first item comes from AOPA Online. This is NTSB addresses volunteer pilot decision making. This is concerning charitable medical transportation flights. And there are actually, I think, quite a few organizations that provide these. These are typically private pilots that offer to fly patients to medical facilities, patients who are in need of care and can't afford to make the trip. Well, it seems that there have been a number of accidents recently. The article points out that there have been 4 fatal accidents in a one-year period. And the NTSB is taking a look at this and is talking about addressing some of the concerns that they find with the safety of these flights. Now, Bruce, I know this is an area that, of course, is very close to you. Is this a serious problem? Is this a pervasive kind of problem, do you think?
Well, I guess I would say it's serious. I would not say it's pervasive. The particular problems that we had occurred back, I believe it was in 2008, and there were actually 3 medical transport flights, angel flight type operations. And most of them didn't, the 3 of them did not involve anything that was particularly in common, but they all pointed up to some shortcomings perhaps in the pilots involved. And with the fact that there are typically hundreds of thousands of these flights over the course of a number of years with no problem whatsoever, and then you have 3 fatal accidents. So that got a lot of people's attention, and they said, well, you know, how are you managing this? And Air Safety Foundation has been working with both the Angel Flights and the Air Care Alliance, which is sort of an umbrella group, and said, you know, how can we encourage both the organizations and the pilots to start doing a little better job of risk management and start looking at some of the challenges and starting to think a little bit more like a professional flight operation. So we're working with them in that particular area, and in fact, we're going to be doing an online program for those pilots to help them in starting to make the decisions and to start thinking like the professionals do.
Interesting. Any idea, Bruce, how many flights or organizations or pilots are involved in this kind of activity?
I'm going to give you an estimate. There are probably at least 100 different organizations.
Wow.
And they are loosely aggregated. So you'd like to think, well, there's just kind of one big parent organization that sort of steers everything and then all of the small individual groups. That's not really the case. Some of the groups are very well organized and they have a pretty good safety standards. Others are kind of more ad hoc, and it depends very much on the individual sponsors of the group as to how stiff their standards want to be. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that I asked when we had a kind of a meeting of the groups, I said, you know, the litmus test for me is, would any of you put a family member in the back seat of any one of your flights?
Right.
And in some cases, you know, they said absolutely, and in other cases, there was a very long silence.
Mm.
So I think that tells us that there is some variability here, and there's some opportunities for improvement.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues we always have to think about is that it's not just flying people on these, you know, medical missions, but anytime you fly with somebody, I think that it's absolutely appropriate for anyone to say, oh, really? So, Bruce, how long have you been flying? You know, how? I mean, what do you normally fly? You know, is this so? Are you a good weather pilot, or can you fly in poor weather? Or, I mean, but see, most people don't even know enough to ask. And certainly, I think that when there are these emotional situations, somebody being ill, it makes it just that much tougher. But by and large, Bruce, I believe the safety record's actually been pretty good, really, overall, hasn't it?
It is good, and I think that therein lies sort of the challenge to say, well, we've got a good record. How can we make it better? And I want to pick up on something that you just said, which is the use of the word mission. And I wrote a column about the mission mindset and the fact that some of these people get into their thought process, well, you know, I'm committed to doing this, and I really do need to get this person wherever they need to go. And that can be a very dangerous sort of thought process, even in routine flying, but especially in these circumstances. And so I've encouraged the groups to drop the word mission and change it to flight or trip or something like that. So we start to think of this as it's a trip, it's not a mission. Sort of like the Blues Brothers, which hail from Illinois.
Yeah,
if you would understand
right.
that, Rob. We aren't on a mission for God here. Our objective is to get the people to wherever they're going in the same condition as when they boarded the aircraft.
That's kind of a brilliant distinction. I mean, simple in terms of the terminology, but very significant in terms of implication, I guess.
Well, we just like to have people, again, we talk about culture a lot, and I do a fair amount of public speaking, and people ask me about safety culture. And as far as I'm concerned, culture is something that I attempted to deal with in a high school lab petri dish. I don't quite know what culture is, but I sure as heck know what mindset is. And I think that's something that we want to start getting pilots to understand. You know, there's a mindset to flying safely, and it's much more about your attitude and your judgment. You need to have a modicum of skill, but
of course,
the attitude is what's important.
Yeah, and that starts with training. I mean, something we're going to talk about a little later as well. I mean, because I think a good flight instructor tries to instill that in a student from the get-go that. I mean, in terms of bad weather, I mean, if it's a difference between flying toward a destination that has a very dark area around it, as in rain or thunderstorms, and it's very light in another direction, it's very simple. Go where it's light. Don't go where it's black. There's some kind of mean weather there. And sometimes you have to start with pilots with some very, very simple decision-making skills because they're completely out of their element when they get 10 feet off the ground.
Some of the toughest things, and we'll get into this when we start talking about the courses, but the easy decisions are pretty easy. The black and white, it's when things start to get gray that it gets really complicated, and I think that's where the challenge comes in. Your point is well taken.
Okay, our next item comes from the New York Times. This is 400 park geese die for human flyers' sake. Well, it seems that geese have been disappearing around New York City. And this kind of came to light in this case of Prospect Park, where kind of suddenly about 400 of them just vanished. Some wildlife biologists and technicians came into the park, gathered up the geese and took them off and basically euthanized the geese. And it turns out this is part of a effort since the notable landing, or maybe you should call it crash, into the Hudson River. Part of an effort to thin the goose population around New York. Now, I mean, there are a lot of issues surrounding this, but let's take a look at it from a safety standpoint. I mean, I think that, you know, wildlife, whether it's geese or deer or whatever, can represent a hazard to air traffic at the airport and around the airport. So it's a significant topic. I don't know, Bruce, have you guys ever gotten involved in this sort of aspect of safety?
Peripherally, AOPA has been quite outspoken, and the guidance I believe that the FAA puts out is certainly for smaller airports, but bigger ones too, is the whole issue of garbage dumps, because that attracts wildlife and obviously birds and things of that nature that get into to jet engines. Piston airplanes seem to have much less trouble with this, but if you know that there's going to be a conflict between wildlife and an aircraft, then the thing to do is to remove the attractive nuisance if you can. And in this case, we're talking about dumps. Now, it's a little bit harder when they're hanging out in a park that's close to the airport.
Right.
And then you've got a value decision to make. As to you know, what you want to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a tough call, but I think, you know, ultimately, in the end, we need to, you know, protect lives first, property second. But like you say, it's the most attractive solution has got to be one that removes the whatever it is that attracts the wildlife.
Well, yeah, New York City, that's going to be problematic because they do produce an awful lot of garbage, but now I'm making an editorial comment, so and we'll probably get lots of mail from New Yorkers all over, so we probably better not pursue that line of...
Okay.
It's hard, but I mean, I don't know what else they could have done. I mean, if that airplane... Let's be serious. If that U.S. Airways airplane had taken off into a cloud deck of about 400 or 500 foot overcast that day rather than, you know, clear blue skies. And they managed to somehow plant themselves over the Hudson when they broke out of the clouds with 10 or 12 seconds left before they hit the water. I mean, and they found out it was related to geese. People would be up in arms. They'd be screaming. They'd be out murdering the geese. But, you know, that's the nice thing about America. Everybody has an opinion, I guess, right? So,
yeah, yeah. Okay, next story comes from Bloomberg Businessweek. Airline challenge to congestion pricing is rejected. Now, this comes about due to an appeal by the Air Transport Association. This was brought before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which denied the ATA's petition to challenge regulations that allow airport operators to charge more for slots at busy times of the day. This was a policy, I guess, that was started a few years ago as an attempt to aid or to reduce congestion at busy airports. And the ATA, representing their member airlines, tried to challenge this, but unsuccessfully. Dan, where do you stand in terms of letting the market operate or controlling it through methods like this?
I'm not sure how I feel about this one yet, to be honest with you. I mean, obviously, the ATA is going to challenge it because basically the airlines at the airports are always in conflict, essentially. Is that, airlines like nice airports that look pretty and operate well, but they just don't want to pay for them. So, I mean, the airlines are obviously concerned about their costs going up.
Sure.
And the airports also see this as a revenue opportunity. I'm not sure if this can really change congestion. Is that it kind of depends how much, because we haven't seen, right now this is just saying that the airports can do it. So we haven't seen any airports implement it and how much they're going to charge. So for this to actually work, the cost needs to be high enough for the airlines to raise their fares to force their passengers to either pay a higher fare or switch to another flight, which I'm not sure. I'm sure some economist with a PhD can figure out the price that needs to be. But also, especially if two airlines are competing on the same route, they don't want to raise their fare first. So I'm not exactly sure. I think in theory this does work, and I mean congestion pricing is used in other areas. I mean, like, I think one of the biggest cases is Singapore with their highway system. One of the, I guess, more successful. I think they saw like a 20% something reduction in traffic or an increase in speed. I forget exactly. But I'm not sure how high the fees need to be to make this work. Or, like, will it really change behavior? Is it just more of revenue for the airports? So I don't think, either way, I don't think for anyone as a passenger that this is really comes out good. I mean, maybe if you're a passenger, it could mean potentially less delays, but if you're flying during a peak time, if you're a business traveler that needs to get there at a certain time, it could mean a higher fare for you. So yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about this yet. I want to see a couple of airports implement it, and then we can evaluate. So I'm going to reserve judgment for now.
Yeah, but something I have to jump out at on this story that I just thought was amazing was the line where it talked about the creativity of the regulators. Has anyone ever used creative and regulator in the same sentence?
I know, it jumps out.
I don't know if I've ever seen that before. I just thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, they've long since lost the point of selling the slots. I mean, now it's just a standard court case. I don't know if anyone's even going to care whether it gets through or not. I don't know.
Yeah, and in the end, I don't know if it's a mechanism that would actually change the behavior of the flying public. I mean, I agree with Dan. If the price differential was significant, then some flyers who have some discretion in terms of what flights they take and when they take them, they could be affected. For business travelers, I think all it would do would be just to increase the price of travel, which wouldn't be a good thing for the industry, it seems. It just seems like there should be other mechanisms that are more effective, but
I know some airports have played around with this, and I know, like, the airline succeeded. I think Heathrow tried to do it one time, and I think the U.S. airlines went against it, went into arbitration. The airlines won, but I forget the exact specifics of it. But, I mean, actually, I think before regulation, if I remember at least Wikipedia correctly, I think actually for the airports in New York, get this to I think in the 60s, to try to reduce GA traffic, and I think as a result, the higher fees for GA traffic during peak times, I think GA traffic was down almost a third. But then again, I think in the New York area, where you have GA traffic, is you have some more, you have alternate options compared to some other places. Yeah. So.
Okay. Next up is from Wired. This is in a first, full-sized robocopter flies with no human help.
I want one.
Yeah, I know. This is like a gigantic radio-controlled airplane, except that it does it on its own. It's autonomous. We've talked about UAVs or remotely piloted vehicles.
Which is it, David? Which is the current slang again?
UAV, unmanned aerial vehicle.
Oh, I thought we had gone to remotely piloted vehicles.
Well, in this case, it's actually an unmanned autonomous vehicle because it's self-sufficient. It flies itself.
That's right.
So remotely piloted doesn't make any sense to call it that.
No.
I see. You're correct. Okay.
So this helicopter took off. It avoided obstacles on its own during the flight, selected a landing site, and landed safely. This is all without human intervention. And this comes about from an Army-funded research team between Carnegie Mellon and the Piasecki Aircraft Corporation. So, yeah, I mean, this is kind of interesting. I mean, we've talked before about the safety and concerns surrounding having UAVs flying around the airspace. Here's an example of something which admittedly is, I think, probably pretty far from seeing any real widespread usage. But here's something where humans aren't involved at all. Rob, if you had something to be nervous about before, this should really tear you up.
Yeah, I'm not real keen. I have enough trouble trying to teach people to fly that are thinking, let alone those not thinking. But
yeah, someday you may be teaching a computer program.
Yeah, oh great. I can hardly wait for that.
Well, it might learn quicker than your students.
Well, that's true. But, you know, part of the fact that it takes a long time to learn is how flight instructors earn their income. You know, I mean, they don't want anybody to learn that quickly.
That's right. You can't
wouldn't
be too
need
good.
Us.
Hold that thought. We'll be getting into that a little bit later, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
All right, moving ahead and also looking farther into the future. This is from Plain Talking, Boeing's Concorde successor. And there's been some studies lately. Boeing has participated as well as some others to look at designs for future supersonic aircraft, something like the Concorde, but maybe not exactly the same. And Boeing has an interesting entry, if you will, into the design for the future. This is actually something that would carry about 120 passengers in a two-class configuration, a little bit slower than the Concorde, but with far greater range, sort of on the order of 5,000 nautical miles, which, as the article points out, that would allow nonstop flights between L.A. or San Francisco and London in about 5 or 5.5 hours. Now, of course, the problem with the Concorde and just supersonic aircraft in general is the sonic boom issue. And the article points out that Boeing's concept is a bit quieter than the Concorde. Maybe doesn't go as far as Lockheed Martin's entry, which is a little bit more exotic-looking aircraft, which tries to, I guess, aerodynamically manage the sonic boom to a much, much greater degree. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if these are just dreams for what may never happen, or if these are designs that may someday lead to actual supersonic aircraft again.
The Concorde served a purpose. I mean, it got very expensive for maintenance-wise, but something like this, with the speed of electronics and everything else and the speed of the world coming, it's got to go back to, there's got to be someone coming along and saying, look, we can get you from Europe to Asia in 5 hours. I mean, there's got to be some value in that.
I think so. I mean, I think the Concorde proved that there was value in that sort of thing, at least for a certain segment of the market. All right, so what's the verdict? Pipe dream, or are we looking at the future here? What do you guys think?
I say it's coming. Unfortunately, it's way slower than I think anybody ever thought, because after the Concorde disappeared, I really thought many people believed something was going to happen. And I understand it's the from my source, at least, it's part of it's the engine technology, but again, the fact that we can't use it across the United States. So people just, you know, it doesn't have as much practical use as people thought it might.
Yeah. I mean, if you can solve the sonic boom problem, which is no small feat, then that would change the game completely, I think.
Fly over Canada.
Fly over Canada, yeah. There's nobody up there to hear it anyway, right?
Well, I mean, there's something to be said for that. You know, I've talked to Grant and Steve about flights over Australia, and in their case, there's nothing wrong with doing a sonic boom over land because there's nothing out in the center of their continent.
Yeah.
There's got to be some corridors where you can accelerate out past Mach 1. We have military aircraft do it all the time.
I mean, like if you're doing a Los Angeles Heathrow, I mean, a great circle distance is going to take you over California, then Vegas, then Utah, then Montana, then North Dakota. So who really cares? I'm kidding. But then it takes you right over Saskatchewan and kind of brings you over northern Canada and Hudson Bay. So still once you get up there.
I was just going to say this, Bruce. I would just point out I'm being a little bit facetious because obviously, you know, those of us up in the airplane aren't having to deal with a sudden kaboom. Whereas if I'm out walking my elk or something up in the Canadian Maritimes or something, that could be pretty disruptive.
Yeah.
So, we need to be sensitive to the environment as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I want to write that down. Walking his elk. Okay, that's very good. But you know what is interesting? And David, how much aren't military airplanes Mach 1 plus over the U.S. all the time?
Rob, what we were saying is, yes, there are military operating areas, MOAs, which I'm sure all pilots know, that aircraft go Mach 1. I mean, it's all part of the training. A lot of times, though, those MOAs are over, especially for like the Navy, are over the Pacific and the Atlantic. But we do have military operating areas in Texas, in the Midwest, where the military has the ability to go Mach 1. There's no reason why civilians can't do that either. They just need to find the corridors. Yeah, you don't want to do a sonic boom over Jersey when you're taking off from JFK. But if you get up high enough, it really shouldn't be an issue.
All right, let's push on to the next story. This comes from Travel Agent Central. NBTA calls for fair display of airline fees. Now, the National Business Travel Association is joining its support or adding its support to the Department of Transportation's proposal that would establish rules requiring airlines to display clearly all the fees at point of purchase. I mean, is there anybody that thinks this is a bad idea?
I mean, I guess if you're really anti anything regulation, maybe. But I mean, I'm for it.
I mean, it makes sense to me.
Yeah, and I think the way I see it, and maybe some airline people let them disagree with me, but I feel, especially in 08, when there's this huge run-up with fees, the airlines were basically trying to charge for everything, and the technology kind of had to catch up. Like, I know Spirit just upgraded their website for CLO ancillary fees, and a couple airlines at a conference I was at about a month ago now said that the vision that they see is sort of like an airline website that's sort of like an Amazon.com.
Right.
That at the end, before you hit purchase, charge my credit card, you'll basically get to a shopping cart and say, okay, here's your base fare and here's every single additional service you ordered. And I'm cool with that. So I think it's just basically a lot of airlines just added fees and they're like, well, we'll figure out the online user experience later.
I can't imagine these not getting through. I mean,
yeah, I can't either. Especially
let's be serious.
Climate.
It was only a couple of years ago you could not even get your credit score because the companies that rated you said, no, this is very proprietary information and we need to keep this secret.
Right.
And I mean, it's crazy that you can book a fare and not actually see the price on some websites until you hit the purchase button. And then you see all the other little bits and pieces come up.
Well, what I find interesting is that the proposed regulation says having the fees regardless of where you buy your ticket. So it'd be pretty cool if I could go into a kayak or something and say, well, I'm planning to, you know, check one bag or something and have all the airfare displays update automatically, because I feel that way if there's actually any difference between carriers, consumers will notice those differences a lot more quickly than they will now, which is involves a lot of research.
Yeah.
So, and I think that actually might make some carriers change their decision. Unfortunately, I mean, if it's for bags, I mean, like someone like Expedia or Kayak can will be able to do that. The one carrier would help would be Southwest, and they don't distribute anywhere other than their website. But other than that, it helps if we go.
Well, I think the old economic model centered around consumers not having perfect knowledge. And I think that, you know, we're just so far beyond that. And we sort of entered the era where the consumer operates in a world of perfect knowledge. And, you know, we see that all the time with the way we purchase goods and services on the internet, for example, where we're able to compare prices and services, capabilities, reputations, people's perceptions, all of those things, you know, very easily online. So I think, you know, it's easier to make money under the old model. And so I don't really criticize the airlines for trying to obfuscate the real cost to the flyer. But ultimately, I think that we're going to see if the airlines don't on their own, you know, provide this kind of information, total price, that the regulations will force it.
And I mean, in some cases, if you're the airline, you want to make it as clear as possible. I mean, the airlines make it very clear. Like, I know at least US Airways does. I think Southwest is doing it now, too. If you want to buy trip insurance, they make it very obvious. I mean, in some cases, it helps the airline to bludgeon you to death with, hey, we have this service available because it's a high-margin offer.
Yeah. All right. Well, this discussion actually leads into our last article. This comes from Swell Blog and Ramblings on Meddling and the Public Good. The issue that's being raised here is that we see all this activity going on the part of the government or regulatory agencies impacting airlines. So we have the, you know, the 4-hour tarmac rule. We have making fees a plain, new rules governing regional carriers, rejection of the slot swap between US Airways and Delta, congestion pricing, all these things. And, you know, one of the issues that's brought out in this post is that, you know, is it appropriate for airlines to be this regulated, to be this controlled, or do we really want to treat them in a different vein? And there's some good arguments, I think, on both sides of the argument.
Well, yeah, but you know, one thing I think is important that Richard mentions is that the airlines brought some of this on themselves. I mean, they really did. Whether it's the tarmac rule, now I don't happen to be a supporter of the tarmac rule. I think it's probably more paperwork than it's worth. But if they had stopped getting all this awful publicity about leaving hundreds and thousands of people trapped on airplanes for hours on end with no potty and no water, this never would have happened. Not to mention some of the other stories that he mentioned that the airlines also initiated. And now they're trying to tell us they're part of the public good? Oh, come on. I think...
It's a stretch.
I think that's a little crazy. They're a for-profit business. They always have been, except that the airlines like to have it on both sides. After 9/11, I didn't see the airlines saying anything about, oh, we don't want any government bailout money because, we're just simply a private company. I mean, they took it like so many other organizations did. It's just crazy. It's not part of the public good.
I don't think you can't have it both ways.
No, I don't think so either. And I think that's what's making people crazy about the airlines is that we hear the stories coming out of the Air Transport Association that seem to say, well, let's see, today's Tuesday. Okay, Tuesday means we have this perspective on the world. And on Thursday, though, we always have that perspective because that suits us better. And I think people are beginning to see through all that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I think the ATA is an example, but I don't think that's different than any trade association. I mean, if you're a trade, you're always going to say whatever you have to say to get the best result for who you're representing.
Well, I don't want to
be
consistent. I think you have to be consistent with whatever the message is up until the point you say, look, we have seen the error of our ways and... Or however you put it, and you say, look, we actually realize that now we'd rather be on this side. But these guys seem to bounce up and back like a tennis game.
Well, I think part of the thing is that we as consumers don't always do what we say we're going to do. Is that, like, in Erlang to say, okay, well, we're going to give more legroom, which American tried to do, or we're going to simplify our fare structure, which I believe Delta tried to do at one point, and then a competitor lowers their fare by $5, and all of us consumers go, ooh, screw everything else. I'm going to go save the $5. So I think that's part of it.
Well, I think we all want to see a healthy airline industry, but, you know, the industry has to recognize that, you know, they have to behave in a manner that benefits the flying public in a way that keeps them satisfied. I mean, you don't have to be perfect necessarily or cater to, you know, every whim necessarily, but there's a certain base level standard of performance that the flying public requires. And if they don't get it, then that's when regulation tends to step in, especially these days. So there you go.
Yeah. And plus you have to evaluate the benefits either way. I mean, so like, I'm not sure if I still get why the DOT rejected the slot swap. Well, the FAA rather rejected the slot swap. Personally, I think that was unfair. At least the concessions they were trying to give out is that, yes, okay, you would have Delta and U.S. Airways would become more dominant at these two airports. But on one hand, small communities, if these slots were given away to low-cost carriers, small communities were definitely losing service. Because on one hand, DOT is like, oh, we need to support small communities. On the other hand, they're like, well, we need low-cost carriers, but if a low-cost carrier is going to go into LaGuardia, they're not going to serve a small community in upstate New York like U.S. Airways is right now. I think the question of regulation, I mean, I don't think it's a question that will be answered, but I think the airlines can back themselves into this. I mean, there is a hearing, and I didn't watch all of it, but this week on ancillary revenue, and of course Spirit was one of the big players there, but I think Representative Overstar, the way he said it, like, if you guys keep adding fees and stuff, you're going to subject yourselves to more regulation. That's not a threat for me. That's just a fact. So, but I do think, in the end, the industry is a lot more regulated than people think it is.
All right, again, we're talking with Bruce Landsberg, president of the AOPA Air Safety Foundation. Bruce, is there one particular safety issue that's most on your mind these days?
Oh, golly, where to begin? We do an annual report called the NALL Report, N-A-L-L. It's named after Joe NALL, who was an NTSB member who was lost in an aircraft accident in Caracas, Venezuela in 1989. And this was a way to memorialize Joe, who was a great general aviation pilot and friend of our activity. So we've been doing this for 20 years now, and we look at where the problems are and then decide how we're going to invest our time and resources to help general aviation pilots fly more safely.
Okay.
And the thing that's, I guess, a little bit discouraging is that over the last, five or six years, the trends are all pretty flat. We've gotten down to a certain level, and I like to think that there's some things that we're doing better, but there are other areas where we're not really moving the needle too far. And there's always the question I get asked, in fact, is, well, how safe is flying? And my response is, it's as safe as you choose to make it. There are a lot of factors that go into that. We touched on a few of them earlier in the podcast about flying on medical flights, and it all depends very much on who your pilot is.
Right.
So we've put a lot of emphasis both into our live safety seminars and into our website, www.asf.org. And the ASF stands for Air Safety Foundation, not Arkansas Shakespeare Festival. I want to make that perfectly clear. So we've got about 30 online courses that are available now for anybody who would like to sign up and take them. And these are based on where we see the problem areas.
Now, these are interactive safety courses, right?
They are highly interactive, and the neat part about it is if you participate in the FAA's WINGS program, you can get credit for that. Even better, if you're an aircraft owner, quite a number of the insurance underwriters now grant accident forgiveness. If you take your course or go to a seminar and plan your accident so it occurs no more than 6 months after you've done either one of those two things, then they won't charge you your deductible, and they won't increase your premiums after the accident, which could be worth thousands of dollars to you. So it's all a matter of timing.
Interesting.
The other thing is we do have a transcript, so you can keep keep score and know how you're doing and so forth, which is viewable only by you and so forth. But some of the courses, I think a lot of people think, well, this is just for more basic pilots. One of the courses I was quite interested in, and it seemed like it was a more basic course, we called it Say It Right, which is about communications. And I suspect all of us have been on the frequency at times, and we've heard other people talking, and you just want to cringe.
Hmm.
And so we put this together and said, you know, if they knew better, they would understand. Well, we got an email back from a senior captain at an airline that shall go nameless, but he said, you know, I took this just kind of on a lark, and I learned something out of it. And we have a little fun in the process of doing this, so it isn't all just straight kind of activity.
Mm-hmm.
So we think it should be interactive, it should be entertaining, it should be fun. We have a course on dealing with thunderstorms and working with ATC, and it's very important, obviously, for pilots who are going to be out flying around, and particularly if you have data link on board and you think, well, I can work this, or maybe you don't have data link and you're talking to air traffic control, what are their capabilities? And did you know that, in fact, working with a TRACON or approach control actually gives you significantly better weather than working with a center?
Huh.
So, and there are ways to play 20 questions with ATC so that you make sure that you're getting the best information that they have available. Popular topic always is decision-making, and we have quite a number of courses and projects on decision-making. We have one called Do the Right Thing, and we were talking about this a little earlier. I believe Rob was saying, well, you know, see that black cloud over there? That's a Stradivarius cloud. You don't want to fiddle with it.
Bad. You know, I have to admit, I didn't know the guy had a sense of humor like this. We had somebody on a couple of months ago that had a sense of humor too, and it kind of got out of hand. So, but that's okay.
I can see how this could go badly. But
the Stradivarius cloud. I don't know, between the Stradivarius cloud and the walking your elk. I this is a whole new Bruce Landsberg.
Well, it's just another side of me. Let's we have multiple facets to personality. So, which one would you like? Anyway, you know, the decision making is easy, and for most of us, and we talk about judgment training and so on. And I guess I'm a little bit skeptical because, you know, when we're being tested on a practical test, or a flight instructor says, "Well, what are you going to do?" You're behaving differently, and just for proof of how people behave differently, I submit for your consideration how do drivers behave when there's a cop on the side of the road with a radar gun?
Exactly, right.
When you are being watched or measured or evaluated, or Dan, when he's taking a check ride for an annual check, we behave differently when we know we're being watched, and we invariably take the conservative choice. But when we're out by ourselves, and maybe the decisions or the choices aren't so clear-cut, and we've got a lot of pressure to either get where we're going, that mission mentality that we talked about earlier, or we got a lot of money riding on it. We've got a big deal, or we've got non-cancelable hotel accommodations, or we've promised some people we're going to meet them, or whatever it is, and we think we might be able to pull it off, but it's not clear cut, that's when it starts to be much more difficult. And so we've tried to interject as much as we can some of those tough decisions into some of the courses, and it's not clear cut as to exactly how it should go. So that it keeps it interesting. We're averaging between 20 and 30,000 course completions, not hits, but completions every single month. And we're very proud of that.
That is amazing. That's at least an order of magnitude greater than I would have guessed.
Well, it was for us, too. When we first started this back in 2000, one of our first courses was on runway safety, and there's an exciting topic for you. But we got a lot of support from the FAA and the Office of Runway Safety, and we're now into the third iteration of that particular course, again, courtesy of the FAA's Office of Runway Safety. And I look back at what we originally did in 2000, and we thought, you know, we were getting 1,500, maybe 2,000 people a month in that and a couple of other courses. And we thought, boy, this is pretty good because at a live seminar, you know, if you're getting 250 people, you feel like you did pretty well.
Sure.
Well, here, for a fraction of the delivery cost, not the production, but for the delivery cost, again, it was an order of magnitude. And as we started to add more courses and broaden things out into all different kinds of areas, it became pretty obvious this was the way to go. Hmm.
Now, you also have stories from real pilots recounting, as I think it says on the site, recounting good flights gone bad. That's a great idea.
Well, there's nothing like talking to somebody who's been in the seat, and we all sort of wonder, well, you know, how would we react, and what were they thinking, and how did they get into these situations? And in some cases, they're victims of circumstance. An engine quits, and you're out over the mountains of Pennsylvania at night in a fairly new airplane. This happened to be a Columbia 400, and Continental didn't hold up its part of the bargain. And now you've got to land, and it's dark, and there are mountains.
Yeah.
And you're talking to an air traffic controller who is vectoring you, and we have that whole story. Or perhaps the story of the, this one got a lot of press, but the story of the private pilot in the right seat of a King Air with his family on board, and his professional pilot in the left seat drops dead instantly of a heart attack as they're climbing through 5,000 feet, and he's never flown the King Air. It's pretty compelling stuff. The other thing that I might mention, which is kind of fun, is you've heard of PSAs. These are what we call pilot safety announcements. In the real world, they're known as public service announcements that run a minute or so.
Right.
And we poke a little fun at fuel mismanagement, at buzzing, at VFR into IMC, all very serious topics, but we take kind of an irreverent look at that to get people to thinking about it, because the people that you want to catch are not the ones that are going to take the course or to go to a seminar.
Mm.
And, you know, that's a question I was going to ask you, Bruce. I mean, do you find that you get multiple hits from the same email? I'm assuming you're probably tracking them by their email or their AOPA member number or something like that. But do you find you get the same, you know, 50,000 people that keep coming back?
Well, that's a very good question. The answer is yes and no. So how's that?
Okay, good.
How's that for equivocating?
There
you know, I'm considering a career in politics here shortly.
Well, you've already got the location.
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you. The yes part is we have some certain high achievers, if you will, who every time we put out a new course, boy, they're right out there and they're taking it, and they're proud of that fact. But we're also making a real effort to try to attract new people to this and say, you know, this is a very easy way to get safety. And safety, as we talked about earlier, is an attitude, and it's not something that you can bolt on to somebody after they've gotten their pilot certificate or whatever. It has to be what I call an intravenous drip. And it's got to be sort of shot into your veins periodically. So Dr. Bruce's prescription is take an online course. It's real easy. You can sit there with your pink bunny slippers and your favorite adult beverage and do it whenever you feel like it. And the courses run anywhere from 30 to 60 minutes, depending upon where you might, which one you choose. And you can leave at any point and pick up because the system remembers where you were, and you can pick up where you left off. It doesn't get any easier than that.
No, that's perfect. That's the perfect way to do online learning like that.
And the price is right.
Well, it is, and I'm glad you brought that up because, as we know, freedom isn't free, free lunches aren't free, and free online courses, somebody has to pay for them. And so we encourage people to please make tax-deductible donations to the foundation because that's how these things get funded. They do not get funded via AOPA dues. We have to raise all the money. And I can assure you that we will spend your dollars more wisely than your government will.
Notice there was no objection.
There was a long silence there. I noticed that.
I know. Well, that's just an opening for about 6 or 8 good jokes, but not at your expense, of course, at the government expense. But I reframed.
Let me add one more thing before we leave online courses and so forth. Is, you know, one of the most amazing things about studying history is that humans don't really learn from history. Hmm. I believe it was Sam Levinson who said, you really do need to learn from other people's mistakes because you won't live long enough to make them all yourself. And that certainly applies to flying airplanes. And if we could get people to just kind of learn about all of the problem areas. We haven't created a new way, really, of crashing airplanes in the last probably 40 or 50 years. Gentlemen, can you think of anything that's new and different?
Not really.
So it's all been done before. You really won't distinguish yourself, so you might as well come online and take a couple of case studies and learn from some of the mistakes that others have made.
Now, Rob, didn't you have a topic that you wanted to bring up?
Well, we were going to talk a little bit about the TAA, the Technically Advanced Aircraft study, the NTSB let a note out last year that basically said technically advanced aircraft have not improved general aviation safety at all, and that was one of the reasons that some people thought, one of the reasons that some of the manufacturers thought would be a good marketing tool was that these aircraft were safer, but I don't want to take that thunder away from Bruce. I think he's probably much more eloquent on explaining that topic than I am. Bruce, save me here.
Rob, I'm not sure that's possible, but the proper terminology. Let me guide you here a little bit, is technologically advanced aircraft. Somewhere along the line, the FAA started with technically, but they are technologically advanced aircraft, which is the terminology we use. The acronym is still the same. But the foundation did a study back in 2007, and we went through in great detail and compared conventional aircraft with glass cockpit airplanes, and the way we defined the airplanes at that point was if they had an autopilot and a multifunction display and a GPS navigator, then that was considered technologically advanced. And of course, even at that point, pretty much all of the new production airplanes going in were being shipped out with glass cockpits. And I guess for me, again, this, in having looked at accidents and studying safety for several decades now, this is sort of deja vu all over again. We make a change in terms of the interface between the pilot and the aircraft, and suddenly we think, well, gee, you know, we've changed that. Everything is somehow going to be different. Well, in some respects it is, but in some respects it isn't. And we have to look at how the airplanes are used. NTSB did mention that, but I think they probably underplayed it. The glass cockpit airplanes as a group are flying a lot more weather because they, at least early on in the process, tended to be on more expensive cross-country aircraft. And that's where the fatal accidents occur. They don't occur that often in the traffic pattern in the training environment. So if you compared, older Cessna 172s that were being used for training and you and then compared that to Cirrus and Columbia. Back then, Columbia 350 and 400 aircraft, which were out flying in the weather, it's a no-brainer to say, well, the airplanes that are out flying in the weather are exposed to greater risks and hazards than those that are flying day VFR in the traffic pattern. And NTSB absolutely confirmed what we found a couple years earlier. The other thing, getting into the academics approach on this, is what we call confounding variables. We looked at one thing, and that is glass versus conventional. But there's so many other things that enter into the equation, which include the pilot, the flight environment, the age of the aircraft, the airports, the geography. If you're flying over flat country, generally you tend to do better than if you're flying over mountainous terrain. What's the pilot experience? How does all of that add into it? So there are a lot of different things that go into it, and just to say, well, glass automatically makes an aircraft safer or more dangerous is probably taking a little simplistic view of the thing, and it just goes way beyond that.
It's not the only factor.
Absolutely not. I mean, look at Airbus, and this gets into Dan's area perhaps, but they've essentially tried to build an almost totally automated airplane, and yet they keep discovering new ways for pilots to get into trouble with it. Or maybe they're not. It's the same old ways. But it's not the glass by itself. And one thing that NTSB did come up with, which we wholeheartedly agree with, is the need for pilots to be familiar. And this is sort of an aha moment, which I think anybody who's ever flown a complicated piece of equipment knows is you got to know the territory. You got to know how the buttons work and so forth. And way back in the early 90s, when GPS navigators were just being introduced to general aviation, the Air Safety Foundation went to the FAA foolishly and said, you know, would it be a good idea if maybe we could standardize on some core functions of this and then let the manufacturers innovate as they would wish? And the FAA said, no, that wouldn't be a good idea at all. And as a result, we have sort of the Tower of Babel at this point, where no two navigators work the same way. And standardization, which has sort of been a mantra of safety for decades, was thrown out the window. So now everybody has to learn every new box and iteration. And some of these things work pretty well, and some of them you kind of scratch your head and wonder what the programmer was thinking.
And you know, one thing I would add to that, you know, being somebody that's training regularly in TAA airplanes now, and I even have a private student, which I've never had before, in a Cirrus. And there's so much more that a pilot needs to understand than they did back when I learned to fly. I mean, we could solo somebody, and Bruce probably remember this, although I'm sure he was just a child at the time, that we could solo people with, there are people that soloed with 7 hours, 8 hours of total time in a Piper Cub or something from a farm field. And it was, nobody thought a whole lot of it. And now we have people soloing in TAA airplanes that have 35 hours before they really feel comfy enough, not just flying the airplane, but operating the electronics well enough to be able to really get up and feel comfy flying the airplane. And that's not that unusual from what I found. I'm curious, Bruce, if you have seen, because I know we're going to drift into this training topic too for just a couple minutes, if you've seen sort of total average times going up with people flying technologically advanced airplanes.
Well, I think the times do go up, but you bring up a very interesting point and one that you could probably start an argument in any drinking establishment in the country, and that is whether primary students ought to be started off in fairly complicated airplanes. I don't have a big problem with electronic flight displays, the flight instruments, for example. I mean, I don't really care if it's glass. Personally, I prefer analog airspeed and altimeter instruments because I think they're easier to read, but hey, I can read drums. Attitude indicator, doesn't matter whether it's electromechanical or all electric, that's perfectly fine. Where things get complicated is when we start getting into the navigator functions. The engine gauges, again, are probably at least somewhat similar. But I had a very telling experience, Rob. You can probably relate to this. Last winter, I took a couple of my friends flying, who neither one were pilots, and it was a nice winter's day, and we were going to go out for lunch. And I was in a Diamond 40 with a Garmin 1000, and plopped them in the front and said, okay, nice day, look outside. It was pretty much everything I could do to keep them from locking in on the screen. And they were just totally overwhelmed by all of the information in which it was presented. And I finally took a folder that I had in my flight bag and taped it over the screen, both the PFD and the MFD, and we still had the backup flight instruments working. And I said, now just look outside. And immediately things got better. And that got me to thinking, you know, maybe we ought to be teaching people the physical airplane skills first, and then we'll migrate them into the electronics. And I realize there's a countervailing argument of people saying, well, that's not the kind, I'm not going to fly like that, so why don't I go from the beginning? But there's something to be said for the building block approach to teaching people. You start with the basics and then kind of work your way up from there and learn the basic physical airplane skills. So I'm going to toss that one out, and I think you'll, in my blog, I got some real interesting answers back on that. I have a weekly blog, by the way, which generates all kinds of comment, but I'll throw that out for you.
Well, if I can jump in on that one, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, and never having had a student in an airplane as let's say, as electronically sophisticated as a Cirrus, I noticed it at probably about the 10 or 12 hour point where we would be trying to make these turns in from the traffic pattern into the landing runway. And I'd be saying, okay, I'm trying to point out the window how the student should be thinking about the picture that they're seeing of the runway approaching. And this fellow was having a great deal of trouble with it. And so I watched his eyes the next time around, and I realized that when he was making the turn from base to final at, what, maybe 400 feet, he wasn't looking at the runway. He was looking at the electronics. And so what I did is the next time around, I turned everything off. I turned off the PFD. I turned off the MFD. And in another hour and a half, he learned how to land the airplane. And I never forgot that.
The prosecution rests.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
I think that we can probably find a way, and we're in the cusp now of the changeover from older instrumentation to newer instrumentation and so forth. But I think there's probably a very good way of learning or teaching people how to learn the physical airplane first. Then we'll start in on the electronics and get that. And I think that may be a very effective way of doing it, and I'm sure there's somebody who will prove me wrong, but I'd sure like to consider it.
Yeah, and I think that I did question, too, whether an airplane like a Cirrus, I mean, I wouldn't do it in a 22. The 22 is the faster 310 horsepower, and I think that's a little lunacy. I mean, the 20 is a 200 horsepower fixed gear airplane. They don't have to fool with a propeller. It's not that bad. It really isn't. Again, once you realize you have to turn off the electronics on them.
That pilots are having difficulty in dealing with all of the count them three left-turning tendency aspects when you apply power abruptly to those aircraft. So that's something to think about as we go into teaching people and even experienced pilots who are upgrading from lower powered airplanes, they got to learn how to use their feet and to be smooth with that power application.
Well, and if you've flown, and well, I don't want to get too complicated here or specialized on stuff that some of the listeners may know about it. If you're in the Diamond, you really learn how to use your feet. in the Diamond, because I haven't flown an airplane that required so much rudder action in a long time. And because the Diamond is just a rudder airplane, and a lot of people are just not used to using their feet.
It that stems from its glider heritage.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So anyway.
All right, Bruce, we want to make sure we leave enough time for a little game we play with our guests called Word Association. And this is just simply where we each say a word or a phrase, and then you just start talking about the first thing that pops into your head.
Oh, great.
And it's just a way to start conversation. So I think actually Dan has volunteered to go first this time.
Yes, because I can't think of anything else. I don't want anyone to think to steal mine.
Hedging your bet.
Yeah, so we're just going to go with Oshkosh.
Oshkosh. Eclectic. Oshkosh is this wonderful conglomeration of airplanes, ranging from very basic up to pretty sophisticated, and it's sort of a county fair, if you will, for aviation.
Since this will be Dan's first visit to AirVenture, do you have any advice for him or other first-time visitors?
Two things. Don't wear a necktie, and wear comfortable shoes.
Great.
And bring a hat.
That would be a good idea.
Yeah.
David, have you got a word?
I'm going to cheat. Airplane geek.
Airplane geek. Present company included.
I mean, you could say Tuesday afternoon, July 27th, 4:15. That would be an appropriate response.
There
but
we go.
You don't feel like you don't have to feel pressure or anything.
An interesting group of people who seem to really enjoy talking about all things aviation.
Yeah, that's us. That's our listeners.
Well, I think that that captures it pretty well.
Okay, great. Rob, have you got a word?
Well, I was going to go before with the pink bunny slipper thing that Bruce mentioned, but I figured that might be a little embarrassing.
Okay,
so,
all right.
I'm going to go with a phrase, your favorite airplane.
Oh, my. My favorite airplane. I'm not sure I can pick one, because there are different airplanes that do different things at different times. I was just looking at my logbook, and this coming Saturday will be 40 years to the day that I soloed.
Wow, congratulations.
In a J3 Cub. So that's an airplane I'm fond of. Back in the day when I was flying for Cessna, the Cessna 310 was one of my favorite airplanes. The Bonanza A-36 is a wonderful airplane. There are so many, it's an unfair question. I plead the fifth.
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one to answer.
Okay, well, let's go back to the pink bunny slippers.
And what would you like to know about that?
Yeah, it's okay. I can see this is going to be a TMI kind of a night. So I will just let you slide on that one.
Okay, Max, it's your turn.
All right, well, you know, I'm going to switch gears, because I was originally going to say young pilots, but, you know, listening to Rob, I think I'm going to change mine instead to old dogs.
We're having a real challenge here, and I guess this is a good thing to sort of close out on. In the pilot population, back in the 1980s, I think we brushed over 800,000 airmen. Not all of them were pilots, but the majority of them were. By the end of this year, we're probably going to dip below 600,000.
Right.
And student starts are down, pilot completions are down, the pilot population is very definitely declining. And it's a huge challenge for the industry, and AOPA and the AOPA Foundation, which I now also am responsible for, have decided we're going to try to work with the industry and with the community at large, people who want to learn how to fly, and try to figure out what's going on. And it's no longer build it and they will come. I think those days are gone.
Right.
And we have to. Warren Buffett, who has said a number of things, very cogently said, you can only charge a premium price if you have a premium product.
Right, yes.
And I'm not sure that, at least in the eyes of many people out there, that our product is worth the price that we seem to think we have to charge. And it's more than just cost, it's about value. And so we could have a long discussion on where that's going. But I think it's now time to start engaging that. And in some of the surveys that we've done, cost is one thing. We've touched on complexity is another. And I think a lot more people would fly if there were a way to do it for less. I'm very enthusiastic about the light sport aircraft movement and sport pilot. I think that's a great way for people to get started. And you're going to hear a lot more on that from AOPA, and we can't do this by ourselves. This needs to involve everybody, from the folks building business jets on down, because you will not have a graduating class to get into those business jets if you don't have a freshman class. And we collectively have to do something, or it's just going to be the five of us at a future airplane geek discussion.
Right. Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right that we have to be very careful about taking this passion that we have for granted, because if we don't manage it, if we don't look into the future, it's going to change to be something else, and what it changes into may not be what we want.
The light sport movement is alive and well in Europe, and you think, gee, how does that work? Well, Cessna, I think, has suddenly figured out that they need to get on the bandwagon, because right now, as good as a $290,000 G1000-172 is, that's a bit much for a training aircraft, previous conversation referenced. So I think there's starting to be a little bit of a realization that we can't start people at that level. We're going to have to start them a little bit lower, get them hooked, and figure out how to deliver that value equation. I think it's going to require some innovative thinking. The training, the way we train needs to change as well, and I'm a big fan of appropriate simulation, and I think that there's a lot more that can be done, but we have to start looking at it in a different way.
Hmm. All right. Very good. All right. Well, Bruce, we'd really like to thank you for taking the time to speak with us this episode. It's been absolutely fantastic. Can you mention again where folks can find your organization? You mentioned ASF.org.
ASF.org is the Air Safety Foundation and the new AOPA Foundation, which ASF will come to reside underneath, but you can still get to us at ASF.org or AOPA.org, and you do not have to be an AOPA member, although we highly recommend it.
Sure.
And donations are cheerfully accepted, fully tax deductible at whatever level you feel that the courses are worth.
And, you know, it also occurs to me that this might be a useful resource for people who are maybe aspiring to be pilots and just want to learn more about what are the kinds of issues they should be thinking about as they sort of progress in aviation.
Well, we will be probably early next year really making a press on educating the consumer, if you will,
mm-hmm.
So that they will be able to come to the website. And we hope to educate them on what is a good flight school like, what is a good flight instructor, what are the questions you should ask.
Fantastic.
And you mentioned earlier, you know, the power to the consumer. Well, I think maybe it's time that we brought some of that into learning to fly, and, you know, that might help us to improve some of our service to our customers.
That's fantastic.
Amen.
Yeah, absolutely. Bruce, thanks again.
The pleasure is mine, and you all have a standing invitation to come to KFDK. It's outside the special flight rules area, and stop in and pay us a visit.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
And that applies to your listeners as well.
Great.
Thanks for coming, Bruce.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you so much. Safe flights, everybody.
And now with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 21, June 24th through June 18th. On June 24th, 1926, Lufthansa,
June?
All will become clear, young Padawan. On June 24th, 1926, Lufthansa begins its Peking expedition flight. Two Junkers G-24 serials D-901 and D-903 take off for Peking, China, now Beijing. The flight would take until September 26th to make the round trip. Deutsche Lufthansa wanted to find a feasible airline route that would connect Berlin to Peking and Shanghai. The flight was over 2,400 miles, excuse me, 12,400 miles, or 20,000 kilometers, with 10 stops. The Junkers G-24 was a low-wing monoplane with three engines, also a corrugated skin, similar to the Ford Trimotor and Fokker Trimotor. The G-24 would eventually lose its wing engines for a more powerful single-engine nose in the aircraft. July 22, 1929, a HE-12D-1717 is launched 250 miles off the coast of New York. The HE-12 is a braced low-wing aircraft on floats. The aircraft was launched via a steam catapult from the steamship Bremen. The aircraft flew 2.5 hours, delivering a full load of mail. Upon arriving in New York, the HE-12 was christened the New York. The 2.5 hour flight actually made the mail arrive 20 hours ahead of the steamship. On July 21st, 1946, a McDonnell FH-1 Phantom, burrow number 48236, makes the first U.S. jet takeoff and landing aboard the Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The FH-1 did 4 arrested landings and 4 takeoffs. The takeoffs were done on engine thrust alone. At the time, the Roosevelt was not equipped with steam catapults. On July 20th, 1969, on a desolate gray landscape, a lone astronaut set foot on another world. Neil A. Armstrong, the commander of Apollo 11, stepped out of the Grumman Lunar Module LM-5, christened Eagle, to walk on the moon. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Edwin Buzz Aldrin followed Armstrong, and they stayed at Tranquility Base for a total of 20 hours. Only 10 others besides Aldrin and Armstrong can say that they are in the same club, and a very small one at that. And Dan, the reason why I'm presenting the segment this way, since you asked. On July 18th, 1938, Douglas Corrigan takes off from Floyd Bennett Field outside New York City. Corrigan began his flying career working for Ryan Aircraft. He had a significant role in the design of the fuel system and instruments on an obscure aircraft, the Ryan NYP, later named the Spirit of St. Louis. After Lindbergh's successful crossing over the Atlantic, Corrigan decided that he wanted to recreate the flight himself. Corrigan spent $310 U.S. on a used Curtiss Robin aircraft. He redesigned the fuel system and gauges, rebuilt the aircraft from scratch. After repeatedly being denied the request to fly from New York to Ireland, Corrigan decided to fly across the country from San Diego to New York and then back. Departing San Diego on July 9, 1938, he experienced several issues with the revised fuel system. Corrigan arrived right and smack in the middle of all the PR surrounding Howard Hughes' world adventure, which we covered last week. With a serious fuel tank leak, Corrigan took off from the field at 5:15 a.m. homebound for San Diego. After 28 hours and 13 minutes of flying and having spent most of the time freezing his feet in puddles of avgas, Corrigan arrived at Baldonnel Aerodrome in County Dublin. He claimed until his death that he did not realize he was off course until 26 hours into the flight, and that his 20-year-old compass had just failed. Thus the legend of Wrong Way Corrigan, the Flying Irishman, was born, which is why I did this in reverse order, the wrong way. First flights that occurred during the week of July 18th through July 24th. The Fiat G-222, otherwise known as the C-27A, and that was July 18th, 1970. And that's the way it was, July 18th to July 24th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, the Airplane Geeks historian.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Now, Dan, do you realize that I never do anything without a purpose behind it?
Yeah, you should know by now, Dan.
That's true. And I apologize from the bottom of my heart.
But I got the right I was expecting someone to chime in that I was doing it backwards, so.
Yeah, I got to give Dan credit for catching that right off.
Yeah, are you proud that I actually pay attention now?
Yes, I am. Very, very much so.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, July 18th, 2010.
Well, g'day folks, it's Steve here for episode 106 of the Oz Desk, and with me is, well, I guess what's left of Grant McHaren. Geez, are you all right there, mate?
Yeah, I'm fine, man. I'm croaking along. I'm mostly here. I think this is one of those little flu things I picked up during my balloonatic phase the other week.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, I've been suffering with a cold and flu for most of this winter, so, you know, it's only fair that you pick up something as well.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got to keep you balanced, mate.
Balance, that's what it's all about here at the Oz Desk. So let's get into a couple of news stories. It's actually been a reasonable news week down under this week. So the first one we're going to talk about this week is Air New Zealand. Are they planning to buy a stake in Virgin Blue or not?
Well, the famous and dreaded sources within the company are indicating that Air New Zealand may be going to buy a chunk of Virgin Blue shares. And, you know, that's quite interesting given that they're doing this trans-Tasman alignment and code share. But that does not involve any shareholding or anything like that. And if they're going to buy shares, it's going to really raise a lot of competition issues and things like that. So naturally, Air New Zealand is denying it madly. They sent out a press release as soon as the news started to circulate. And they've denied that any of this is happening at all. So, yeah, we could apply the old rule of thumb that the more somebody denies it, the more likely it is to really happen, perhaps.
Yeah, the interesting thing is here that Air New Zealand has issued a statement to the Australian Securities Exchange in which it said that, quote, Air New Zealand is conscious that the airline alliances, such as the one planned with Virgin Blue, frequently include an equity aspect, but the proposed alliance does not do so. They are denying it pretty heavily there, and if they're saying it to the ASX, Grant, well, you know, they'd want to be careful about saying something and then changing their mind very quickly.
Yeah. It's definitely not happening, or if you read between the lines and the way it's written, it's not happening the way that everyone says it's going to happen. So they can turn around and do something that's different to what they said because, oh, no, we just said we wouldn't do A, but here we are doing B, which looks a lot like A but isn't, you know,
yeah.
That kind of thing. There's a lot of stuff going on about Air New Zealand and Virgin with their Trans-Tasman tie-up. There's a lot of stuff going on with Virgin itself, Virgin Blue, and the whole V Australia, V Pacific, all that kind of stuff, because here's the next piece about Virgin is that there appears to be a name change delay. We thought it was going to be Singapore Airlines that they needed to get it agreed with there, but it seems that Virgin Group in general is having a disagreement with Virgin Blue that is impacting and delaying the relaunch of the airline. So it may not be the start of next year. We may have to wait until then to find out what's happening, which will probably make John Borghetti a little upset. But there's an indication in this article here in Australian Aviation, our favorite aviation magazine.
Absolutely.
It says that around the time that V Australia was named, Virgin Blue attempted to trademark the name V Pacific, but the Virgin Group apparently blocked it. So, Steve, you may have been right. They may have been going for V Pacific instead of V Australia.
Yeah, I still like the way Virgin Pacific sounds. I don't know where they get this V from, but, you know, anyway, Virgin, I think it rolls off the tongue nicely. So I should have laid some money on that with you last week, mate.
Yeah, I think so, but it's not definite yet. I could still win on V Australia and, you know, V for victory, mate. But just interesting that now it's Virgin Blue going up against their own headquarters in the Virgin Group, causing some trouble. So, yeah, we're not out of the woods yet, and maybe we're going to have to wait until the start of next year to find out what on earth's happening with the Virgin Group. But something we don't have to wait for the start of next year for is that the Qantas Group reckons they're going to have their 787 deliveries early in 2012. They're going to receive the 787-8, and they're also going to receive a few 787-9s when they come out. So during 2012, they reckon they're going to receive 15 787s.
Well, nothing like being optimistic, mate. How's the testbed aircraft going over there in Seattle? I think it's done, you know, several hundred or maybe even several thousand hours now. I'm not actually sure.
Yeah, well, it's done a lot of testing, but there has been a rumbling that ANA may have to wait a little longer for their first delivery. The first indications have come up that delivery date to ANA may slip out further than the end of this year.
Yeah, they're saying here that Jetstar's getting the 800 series from 2012, as Grant said, and the Dash 9s, they'll be delivered from 2014. So still a few years away, but Qantas has placed a lot of stock and a lot of time and I guess a lot of dollars in getting these aircraft across here to Australia and getting them running. So I guess from that standpoint, the sooner they can get that happening, the happier they'll be.
Oh, yeah, because that lets them give the A330s back from Jetstar to Qantas, which lets them finalise the retirement of their 767s. So Qantas can get rid of those aircraft, which are getting pretty long in the tooth now. It also means that Jetstar will be able to base the aircraft probably in Singapore and open up Europe. The indications are that Jetstar is waiting for these aircraft to be able to push hard into Europe, and most likely they will be based in Singapore, which means there's a high chance that they will be registered in Singapore. At the moment, the indications are that if you want to register an aircraft in Singapore, you've got to have a 51% Singaporean-owned and controlled entity to register that, but there may be a loophole that lets them get through with an entity that's owned by other Singaporean companies that in turn are also owned by others, so technically Australia still controls it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that all just sounds far too complex for my simple mind, mate. Let's move on to something a little bit local, and we've talked before on the Ausdesk about Australia's most predominant, I guess, regional carrier, which is Regional Express, better known as Rex. They've been voted recently the best regional airline on the planet.
That's right. According to Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine, they reckon Rex is the top performing regional airline of the world. Woohoo!
Yay.
From down under, we strike. Ha ha.
There we go.
So the ranking was based on an examination of all publicly traded airlines in the world, looking at financial ratios, 19 financial ratios compiled over a period of 10 years. So this wasn't a consumer survey or anything like that. This was assessing the publicly available data on the financial performance of these regional airlines.
Yeah, they run a great fleet of Saab 340 aircraft. I think a lot of those ones actually they bought originally from the US. They were running with United or one of those.
Yeah, they did have a lot of 340As and now they're mostly 340Bs. But another interesting part and linking back to our previous story is that Rex is actually partially owned and managed by a Singaporean organisation.
Yeah, there's not a lot of other regional carriers around. Probably the next biggest one would be QantasLink, which is a conglomeration of a number of smaller companies that all sort of operate under the QantasLink banner. So, yeah, Rex, they do well to hold their own, and they provide a very important service going out to a lot of the larger regional cities that perhaps wouldn't otherwise have airline service at all, and perhaps back in the older days, as I've said many times before, would have been instead serviced by the railways.
Yes, and Rex also have their Pilot Academy, where you can learn to fly the Saabs, and by selling your soul to Rex for a period of, I think it's about 5 or 7 years, they'll train you and then you work that training bond off by flying for them.
Mm.
So make sure that they don't train people up who then get snapped up by the majors.
Well, they might not be flying anywhere, Grant, if the next story we've got on the list here is true. It looks like there might be a fuel strike coming up.
Yeah, well, that's right, mate. The Transport Workers Union is claiming that flights around Australia could be disrupted next week if fuel workers strike over a pay dispute. What's happening is that permanent staff are being paid more than the casual colleagues to do the same job. So the labour hire section of the workforce would have their wages reduced between $14,000 and $16,000 Aussie dollars a year, and that they would pay the direct hire employees who do the exact same work under the exact supervision and the same clothes a 5% wage increase each year for the next 4 years. So, yeah, this is a casual group not happy with what's happening with the permanent group and possibility of a strike.
Yeah, well, look, this is a very common thing. You see this a lot in the airline game, actually, to be honest, in this country, where a lot of stuff is outsourced to these labour hire organisations who just do it cheaper. And it's not only the airlines, I guess, and I'm sure our friends in the United States would be seeing the same sort of thing really everywhere. I mean, a lot of companies now just would prefer to pay somebody else to pay their own employees to do it for a contracted rate for as cheap as possible. And it looks like that's what's happening here. The interesting thing is that field workers in this country tend to try and go on strike around Christmas. And last time I looked, it's only the middle of the year. So,
yeah, it's not
Christmas
the Easter
in July,
holiday.
Grant.
It's not the winter holidays they've been. It's like, yeah, what? Who are they trying to disrupt by going out on Wednesday next week?
What were they thinking? Bad timing. Anyway.
Well, we'll see what happens, because this will impact Qantas and Jetstar the most because they use Australian fuel services to refuel their aircraft.
Yep. Okay, a couple of quick ones just before we finish, Grant. Tell me this is not true. Another low-cost carrier coming to Australia?
Yes, there's a chance. Indonesian carrier Lion Air has been looking at Australia for a number of years and considering that they'd like to start flying here in Australia. And maybe they've been watching Tiger and seeing how they're doing so well despite their crap performance and bad service. service and so on. And Lion may be thinking, well, hey, you know, we could just do the same and make some money here. So, yeah, Lion Air from Indonesia, very possible that they will be starting. They're just waiting for government approval to launch services, apparently.
Well, that's very nice of them to come here because I'm getting tired of picking on Tiger Airways. So, you know, nice to pick on another cat.
Well, yeah, exactly. We can have Tiger and Lion and you know, and set the two against each other.
Yeah, not fly either of them. Anyway, speaking of planes that are not flying, we mentioned last week the MRH-90 that the Australian Defence Force is ordering here. And we also mentioned that they're grounded. Well, Grant, according to this article in australianaviation.com.au, they're still grounded.
That's right. It's been nearly 3 months since an aircraft experienced an engine failure near Adelaide. Quite a catastrophic engine failure, by the way. The whole turbine just fragmented itself and destroyed itself. They've grounded the entire fleet and they're still investigating and figuring it out. So this is not a real good mark for the MRH-90. And as we said last week, this is probably a reason why we have very probably gone to the Team Romeo solution for the Navy helicopter. It was up against the NH-90, which is a navalized derivative of the MRH-90. But with all our MRH-90s grounded because of this, maybe it didn't look so good at them and they've gone with Sikorsky. Also very interesting that the engine in question is also used in a number of European NH-90s, the AW101s and Apaches as well at the British Army, but none of them have been grounded. It's just our ones.
Got to make you wonder whether this has just been a freak happening and, you know, this sort of thing could happen. You know, I'm tipping to any sort of engine. I mean, it may just be a one-off thing, not something that's, you know, endemic to all of these aircraft. And then, like you say, they are used extensively in other parts of the world. So yeah. Could be a lot of politics going on. And of course, since we last spoke to our listeners on the Airplane Geek Show, Australia is now in election mode. So there's going to be a lot of political posturing going on over this and many other subjects over the next 5 weeks until hopefully we've got a new government. Anyway, speaking of things that are going away, Grant, like hopefully our government.
And but these ones, unfortunately, are going away too soon.
Yes.
The F-111s are doing their last ever international defence exercise before they get retired at the end of the year, flying alongside aircraft from New Zealand.
What?
That's right, they're P-3s. Oops. I was thinking combat aircraft for a second. But yeah, no, F-111s will be flying alongside Kiwi aircraft, Singaporean and Thai air forces as part of the Pitch Black exercise in the Northern Territory. It's Pitch Black exercise is a lot of fun to watch. All the aircraft staging in and out of places like Darwin, Cairns and Townsville.
Mm.
But yeah, it's going to be sad to see them go. This is their last ever international exercise. And I just wish they could keep them going until, you know, March. Just keep a few on hand until March or so, just so we could see them one last time at the next Avalon Air Show next year.
Yeah, not going to happen, mate, unfortunately. Air Commodore Mel Hupford from the Royal Australian Air Force says that the F-111s have served Australia well for the past 37 years. And I reckon he'd be right. But unfortunately, all good things must come to an end. And, you know, this has been in the works for well over 12 months now, the retirement of this aircraft type, and now we've taken delivery of quite a few more of the FA-18F Super Hornets. And those aircraft have been ordered to replace the F-111. So, you know, one era ends, another era begins, and on we go.
The king is dead, long live the king, that kind of thing. Yeah, I know, but wouldn't it be great? Imagine seeing three F-111s doing formation aerobatics at the next Avalon as they go bye-bye, because who cares? We're gonna scrap them. We don't worry anymore about their life expectancy. I mean, I've actually seen an F-111 do a loop. It was absolutely amazing. I think it was at 5,000 feet as it came around the top. Absolutely amazing view. And the barrel rolls and all that they were doing many years ago when they first got them out of the life extension program.
Well, Grant, that gives me one more great segue. And speaking of life extension, I think you want to take yourself off to bed now.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'll go put myself to bed with a nice Lem sip and something else to help my throat. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Knock yourself out for a couple of days.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, boss. I'll let them know at work.
Yeah, have a couple of days off. I'll write you a certificate.
Awesome. Thanks, mate.
Well, until next week, at least I know I'll be back next week, and hopefully Grant will be too. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm the croaking Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Oh, Rex, huh? I'm not familiar with Rex. Dan, in 10 seconds or less, if you had to give the award for best regional airline, what would it be?
Best regional airline. Best regional airline. Wow.
I caught you, huh?
Well, here's the problem is that, like, Rex, you actually know Rex is a regional airline. but over here in the States, there really aren't that many regional airlines that you know. I mean, they're all operating under the mainline brand.
Yeah, but that's true.
I'd say the cool one that I know, at least where I live, is Cape Air, and I've never flown them. I hear they're cool. But yeah, I'm trying to think. I think right now the one I'm finding most interesting for regional-wise, business-wise, would be Republic, with them leaving the regional market, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
But, yeah, and actually I think ATW gave them that award at least a couple years ago.
All right. Well, thanks, thanks as always to Grant and Steve for the Australia Desk Report. All right, we're running really long, but let's move on to listener mail. First one that came in from Peter. He said, just want to say how much I've laughed recently following some of the old Geeks podcasts. Seems he's working through some of the early episodes and discovering them to be quite a source of entertainment. He has several comments. One, though, is I think the one that really made me laugh was a more recent episode, episode 98, I think, when Dan did the German impression about Lufthansa. I was listening on the train and I almost wet myself. The other passengers looking at me with my iPod on, wondering what I was listening to. So he goes on and begs a question that maybe one of the things you can have in your back pocket when you need a break from recording is to have a favorite moments episode, or you could always put it to the listeners on the website to vote for their favorite Airplane Geeks moments. Yeah, maybe that's something that we could consider doing.
I'm only aware of that because at least my version of history is that usually when a sitcom reaches its peak and they run out of ideas, they do a best moment show, mm-hmm. and then from then on, everything is downhill.
It does.
But that's cool. First, it's cool that Peter's going all the way back, because I think I was telling you this, Max, but I think there are some listeners who are more dedicated to this podcast than we are. No, but and it's cool. Like I said, I mean, Peter, I think he wrote an email, listening has revitalized my interest in aviation. And for the first time in 28 years, I'm off to Farnborough. So that's really cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. In fact, I encouraged him, and I know at least a couple of other listeners as well who are headed off to Farnborough to think about sending us a report, something short, just their impressions. Audio would be great. A minute or a couple of minutes would be wonderful. So we encourage our listeners to give us some Farnborough feedback. Next, we had Richard. Richard writes, "I love listening to the podcast here in the UK, and whilst I'm on the road. I actually started listening to it whilst in Australia earlier this year. I'm coming over to the States during the summer, starting off in Seattle, naturally going to Boeing Field, then doing the West Coast before traveling along the East Coast. My question is, what would be your recommendations to see or visit aircraft-related sites, museums, or shows along the way? Thanks for putting the show together each week." So I know I responded with a couple of ideas. I think when I think across the whole country, and what are the top sites? I think we mentioned actually last episode the U.S. Air Force Museum in Dayton is a must see. The Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in D.C., including the Udvar-Hazy facility in up by Dulles, is a must see. Another one on my list is the Pima Air Museum in Arizona, which is just a fantastic visit. They have, when I was there, almost 1,000 aircraft, many restored, many not, some indoors, some out. But that's quite an exciting visit. So I don't know if you guys have any sort of must-see destinations in the U.S.
Museum of Flight in Seattle.
Okay, sounds good.
The Cradle of Aviation Museum out on Long Island. Let's see, where else? There's Kermit Weeks Museum outside of Orlando, Florida. I forget what he calls that. That's really good.
That's the Fantasy of Flight, I think, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Fantasy of Flight. There's the Experimental Aircraft Association Museum located at Oshkosh.
Of course, right.
There is, what's the one that restores all the warbirds in outside of Los Angeles?
Side of Los Angeles.
Oh, out in the desert. Restored
oh, you mean
the flight
at,
wing.
At Mojave?
No, not at Mojave.
Oh.
Planes of Fame in Chino.
All right, cool.
Oh, Chino. Ah, yes.
One place that I'd like to add.
Yeah.
If anyone goes to Boston Logan for a bit of aviation history, there's actually a plaque that says, here in May 1994, three-year-old future host of the Airplanes podcast, Dan Webb, took his first flight. You might be looking for it for a while. But
yeah, I bet. All right, those are all great suggestions. And if our listeners have any others, please consider adding them. These are under the episode 105 comments, so feel free to add more in there. We got a couple of messages from Alex concerning our discussion last time about right seat, left seat, helicopters versus planes, and why there's a difference. And Alex wrote that the captain of a helicopter sits in the left seat in a Bell 47 and Strom MD-369 and 269 series helicopters. The Bell 206 and R-22, you sit in the right seat. They sit in the middle in a Kawasaki or Bell KH-4, and three passengers sit behind the pilot. It probably has to do with center of gravity issues, depending on what machine it is. As you can see, the pilot or captain can sit in a different seat. In the Skycrane, apparently the pilot in command sits behind the front pilot, depending on the operation that they are doing. Well, we had a couple of other emails also about this issue of right seat on many helicopters and left seat on airplanes. And so what I did was I actually sent an email off to someone who I figured might have at least an interesting story to tell about that. And that was Igor Sikorsky III. And Igor wrote back saying this, great to hear from you, and great question about the pilot placement. It comes up from time to time. I think I am right in the response here. My grandfather and his engineers had to work this problem out from scratch. There are four controls which require constant manipulation during many phases of helicopter flight: rudder, cyclic pitch, collective pitch, and power. The rudder is with the foot pedals. The cyclic is with the stick. Both are very similar to airplane controls, at least for cruise flight. The collective lever and the throttle remain and were combined in one lever. The pilot's arm operates the collective, and the pilot's wrist operates the power. I believe, and will check, that it was deemed better for the pilot to operate the stick with the right hand, as most people are right-handed. This might have been my grandfather's preference. This left the left arm for the collective. The early aircraft had only a single collective lever, which of course had to be located in between the seats for dual access. This made the pilot use the right seat if he wanted to use the stick in the right hand. Igor goes on, that's, I think, the explanation, but we'll clarify it with my uncle, who will know for sure. So there it is from Igor Sikorsky III. And if he comes back with some more facts from his uncle, we'll be sure to pass those on.
I think that's pretty cool that you got that.
Yeah, Igor actually runs a sporting camp along with his wife, Karen, in the North Maine woods. There's really only two ways to get there. The preferred method is float plane. The other way you can get there is by driving for about 3 or 4 hours on dirt, or, well, unpaved logging roads, but only if it hasn't been raining. And actually, it's a fantastic camp. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's on a lake, obviously, for the float plane. There is no one else on the lake, and it's really a fantastic fantastic way to spend a week or some vacation time. But one thing he does is each year he holds what he calls Sikorsky Weekend. But what he does is for like a 3-day weekend, he focuses on the history of his grandfather and the development of helicopters. And he's got tons of memorabilia and old footage that you generally don't see, and just tons and tons of information. So if you're really a helicopter geek, it's something to look into. The camp is called the Bradford Camps, and you can find that at bradfordcamps.com.
One quick comment. As a lefty, can I claim discrimination here?
Yeah, lefties have it tough, man. You can't fly helicopters. There's a rule. One more from the many emails that we got. This one from Brian. Brian sent in a link. He says, this has absolutely nothing to do with aviation, but I recently saw something that made me think of David mentioning rainbows and unicorns. Have a look at the April Fool's imagery product that ThinkGeek offered up this year. And I'll put link in the show notes, but it's thinkgeek.com/stuff/41/unicornmeat.sthtml. So if you continue to be interested in the rainbows and unicorns topic, please check that out.
That was pretty funny.
It really was.
Yeah, it tastes like chicken.
So thanks to all the others who wrote in. Huss sent in a great note. You can see that in the comments to at the airplanegeeks.com site. Okay, anybody got anything else?
No, see y'all in Oshkosh.
Well, I have an essay I'd like to share, actually.
You have a what?
Essay I'd like to share, actually.
An essay.
You still owe us poetry, Boy Wonder.
That's right. You were supposed to give us some poetry last week.
Yes, I will. I will. This week I will sit down and write some Rob Mark haikus.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. All right, we'd really like to thank our guest, Bruce Landsberg, from the AOPA Air Safety Foundation. Really fascinating conversation. Invite people to go check that site out and see what you can learn. Thanks, as always, to Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron from PlaneCrazyDownUnder.com for the Australia Desk Report. David, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof or on my blog at WhatJustFlewBy.com.
And Rob Mark?
Let's see, once I unmute the mic, so... Oh. Did you notice all the locusts have gone to bed?
Oh, thank goodness.
Now, that's a wonderful thing. Well, let's see. This week it's special when you say, where can I find you? Because certainly at jetwine.com for Scott and I on the blog, or at Jetwine on Twitter, or on Tuesday, July 27th at Air Venture.
Yeah, this is going to be exciting.
Along with Dan Webb.
And Mr. Webb, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage. My blog at thingsinthesky.com. You can also, well, as of this Saturday to Thursday, and then again on the following Saturday, you will also find me at AirVenture. So if anyone's going to be around, feel free to just, you know, shoot me an email, shoot the podcast an email. So maybe we can meet up. But then also, just while we're Max, while you're paying people, just thank you to everyone for listening. So we're just not a bunch of idiots talking to ourselves.
No, we're not geeks.
I'm Max Flight. You find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes and listener comments. We're also on Stitcher now, stitcher.com. Check that out, or you can click. There's a link on the website. Stitcher is it's kind of a streaming radio concept where you can listen to the Airplane Geeks as well as some other aviation podcasts anytime that you like, streamed to your mobile device, your smartphone, or other similar device. Follow us on Twitter at Airplane Geeks.
But Max, what if someone wanted to call in and leave a comment?
Well, let's ask Benet.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet. All right, join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everyone.
Night, everybody.
See you later. Thanks for listening.
Hail, hail. Oh, and I brought the dog with me today, too. You want to say hi, Simba? No, he says he doesn't want to say hi. He just wants my food.
Why is your dog named Simba, really?
Because he's a Rhodesian Ridgeback, and we wanted something sort of originally African.
Our guest today is Bruce Landsberg. Bruce is president of the Airline Owners and Pilots Association Air Safety Foundation. Our guest today is Bruce Landsberg. Bruce is president of the Airplane Owners and Pilots Association Air Safety Foundation.
Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association.
Oh, no.
The third time is a charm, Max.
Yeah.
Just say AOPA and get it over with.
I know. I was personally leaning towards more of a physical challenge of some sort. I don't know yet.
Arm wrestling or something?
A physical challenge, yes. Oh, let's tell everybody there's going to be an arm wrestling contest.
Right, against
to see
Dan.
Who the upcoming guest is going to be.
Sounds
see, that's
like
what
fun.
We need you there, David. You could help moderate the arm wrestling.
Dateline July 18th, 2010.
Oh, good day, folks. It's Steve here.
Whoa!
That didn't work.
Wait.
All right, now.
Max! Oh,
check. I.
Yeah, of course, Rex offers operates a reasonably sized, reasonably large fleet of Saab 340 aircraft. And, Grant, do they run some Beech 1900s as well, I think?
No, I'm pretty sure they're all Saab, mate.
Yeah, pretty sure. We'll just edit that bit out.
An interesting part of Rex. Okay, so do you want to just say, yeah, they run a great fleet of Saabs, yeah?
Yeah, they run a great fleet of Saab 340 aircraft. I think a lot of those ones actually.
And our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com.
Oh, no. Not another 2 hours of recording.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that I forgot to press record. We're going to have to do it over again.
It was her birthday last week, too.
I know.
She was young.
Very diplomatic, Rob.
You just do everything you can to get in hot water with that woman, don't you?
And she just said something very nice on Twitter tonight. I'm not trying to get in hot water. I'm trying to be. You know, we just playfully tease each other. Okay. Is what we do.
I think she might take back the woman card you were just given back.
Oh, God!
Let's call it a night.